Welcome to the Science Trash Cast for August 10th, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week's show is all about waste, featuring Garbology 101, the challenges of metal recycling, contemplating an end to all waste, and confronting the yuck factor.
It's often hard to get people to talk seriously about sanitation, to get celebrities, for example, to be seen digging latrines.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Today, garbage is such a monumental problem, it seems a near miracle that our waste disappears from our curb and our thoughts every week. Yet in our dealings with trash, we mainly rely on the same three choices our ancestors had: bury it, burn it, or abandon it. But as waste levels rise and environmental concerns abound, things are getting a bit more complicated. Science news writer Jeffrey Mervis gave Edward Hermy a crash course in Garbology 101, starting with one of the oldest solutions, burning trash.
Historically, there were incinerators open down at the city dump, and you would take the trash there and burn it. And that was okay when you had lots of room and people didn't worry about pollution. But probably in the 30s and 40s, that became a bigger issue. It became a health problem, sanitary problem, pollution problem. And so the modern technology goes beyond incineration. It has a lot of pollution controls. It removes a lot of the toxic material. And what actually goes out of the smokestack is much purer than what had been the case in the past. But there's still residual opposition to that in a lot of communities. So in some countries and in some communities, incineration is accepted and done on a scale that cities are comfortable with. In other cases, it's a political hot potato, and therefore communities have to look for other ways to dispose of their trash.
So there's a new technology also called waste-to-energy plants. And these sort of hold a unique position between both waste disposal and energy production.
Right. Well, the idea behind waste-to-energy is that there is a lot of energy in things we throw away, in particular plastics. They have a high BTU value. The challenge is extracting that energy in a way that is economical. And so what these plants do is burn at very high temperatures and also remove the hazardous materials so that what you're left with is something that is much smaller in volume and smaller in weight. The value of that is that there's much less to take to a landfill. The added advantage is you can produce energy, which you can then put into the grid. You can sell to utility companies. And proponents of waste to energy say not only are they solving a problem with how to dispose of waste, but they're actually generating energy that would otherwise have to be generated through the use of fossil fuels. And therefore, they're reducing CO2 emissions and reducing the amount of raw materials that need to be extracted and processed in order to make electricity and power.
So are there any drawbacks to this type of energy source?
Well, the main issue is the quality of the emissions and the economics, whether you can run these efficiently to make money and also address the health concerns.
So let's switch gears to talking about recycling. What are the most important factors when a county builds a recycling plant?
So for most people, recycling is what waste is about. They feel that should be the goal. And I think waste professionals agree with that, but it's not that simple. Again, how much money, effort, trucks, manpower it's going to take to collect that material from the curbside, bring it to a central location, process it, and then manage it. In other words, find a market for it, separate out the things that can't be recycled, dispose of those, and then continue. So those are the factors that a county or a municipality looks at.
So, you know, you go into the inner workings of recycling plants. Does it really matter that much how well I sort my recyclables before they're picked up?
It matters a lot. The bane of any recycling operation is those thin plastic bags that blow around along the side of the road. They literally gum up the works, and they have to be removed because that's not the kind of plastic that is valuable.
So is this grocery bags or what type?
These are the thin grocery bags.
Okay.
Kinds of things that, again, some municipalities have put a tax on in an effort to reduce their usage. You know, 20 years ago, the debate was paper versus plastic. But then the experts realized that what you really want to do is reduce the use of those bags as much as possible, whether plastic or paper.
Mm-hmm. So there are many systems for dealing with waste, but how can we get to a state where we're not generating any waste?
Right. Well, the phrase zero waste is something that means different things to different people. I think most experts agree it's a nice slogan. It serves a political purpose. Practically speaking, it's not going to happen anytime soon. But some companies have adopted a goal of what they call zero waste to landfill. What that means is they promise that even if they're generating waste, it will be in a form that won't need to be buried in a landfill. It will be recycled in one way or another, or it will be burned, or it won't be created at all. So the far end of the zero waste movement says prevention is the key. Don't buy. Don't purchase that item to begin with, and then you won't have to worry about recycling it, much less disposing of it. Now, that's a pretty extreme position for most of us, and certainly for Fortune 500 companies that depend on the world to buy their products.
So here in the U.S., what are some of the future challenges to regulating waste?
Well, part of the problem is that only a very small portion of waste is actually regulated in any strict way. Municipal solid waste, the stuff you and I produce in our homes or in our offices or at the store, is only about 3 to 5% of the total. Then there's another very small percentage of hazardous waste. These are really toxic materials. And in the U.S. and in most industrialized countries, those two streams are regulated very heavily and closely. But the vast majority of waste from mining, from agriculture, from construction, from all these other processes are not regulated if they're not deemed to be hazardous and they're not considered to be municipal solid waste. And so that leaves most of the iceberg underwater and therefore invisible because, you know, you and I don't think about it.
Yeah, what isn't thought of isn't regulated.
Exactly. And there are also, you know, political and economic reasons why those producers would prefer not to have those waste streams regulated. And so the laws that are passed and the rules that EPA enforces obviously have to take are part of that political milieu. They're not operating strictly on what would ideally be the best way to manage our waste.
So this all sounds pretty grim. Are there any prospects that we have to be optimistic about for managing waste?
Well, I think that we have learned a lot. There was a project at University of Arizona that studied what people threw away. It ran for about 30 years, and they learned lots of surprising things about what does and doesn't decompose, about what does and doesn't get thrown away. And I think the more we understand what people dispose of, the better we can devise systems to handle that. I think recycling is now generally well accepted. It's embraced by most communities, by most consumers. The challenge is to go beyond recycling, to say, okay, you're putting that plastic container back into the system rather than burying it or burning it and losing its value. So the next question is, how can we be more efficient at extracting the value from that plastic container, as well as can we continue to make those plastic containers lighter, use less plastic, or not use them at all, have other kind of containers that are infinitely recyclable. So I think a lot of the waste professionals are trying to get people to think in creative ways about how to do that more efficiently, more effectively, and economically, because it still has to be within the budget of a community to be able to afford to manage.
Well, Jeffrey Mervis, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
Science news writer Jeffrey Mervis puts garbage into perspective in this week's special issue on waste. For our full collection on working with waste, visit www.sciencemag.org/special/waste.
When we think of metals, what comes to mind are probably steel, aluminum, tin, the common metals we use every day and throw into the recycling bin without a second thought. But large industries like automotive manufacturing and consumer electronics utilize a lot more than those, including precious metals like gold and platinum, and rare metals like indium and gallium. It takes money and infrastructure to get these metals back out of products. So how is the world handling this new type of metal management? Barbara Reck spoke with me about the challenges facing metals recycling.
When we think about recycling, there are two aspects that we see a challenge of. One aspect is a metal recycled at all? Does it enter the recycling chain? And once it enters it, are we doing a good job in dismantling the product, in separating the various metals, and in the end, recycling them and retrieving them in the final smelter? And the other aspect of it is, what metals are we talking about? Are we talking about the main metals, like the steel and the aluminum and the copper, the precious metals, or are we talking about the specialty metals? And those are metals that are used only in very, very low amounts for some often new high-tech applications, like the indium for LCD screens or the gallium in solar cells. And this is the majority of the metals that we are speaking of today. And those, for the time being, we are not recycling at all. And that is a huge challenge.
So we have a lot of technical challenges, and we also have differences from metal to metal.
Yes.
So taking a step back, if you were to look at our global processes for recycling metals, what sort of grade would we get? How good a job do you think we're doing at recycling the metals that we use?
This is, again, a question that very much depends on the type of metals. And what we did, we grouped them in those three different types of metals where we see those common metals, as we call them, which includes the steel, the aluminum, zinc, copper, lead, nickel. And those we would rate with a B because we are doing a fairly good job. There's always room for improvement. But overall, here we have established systems and that's working well. Similarly, the precious metals. Precious metals are used in both industrial applications and in consumer applications. And those industrial applications, which are a big end use for them, I would give them an A because they are just doing a really, really good job in tracing the material throughout the life cycle. While when we are thinking about precious metals that are used in electronics or in like the platinum in the car catalysts, we are actually not doing a good job at all because we have problems and we only give them a C or a D. And the specialty metals, those very rare metals, the rare earths, the indium, the gallium, we are not recycling them at all, so that's an F. Altogether, we are talking about 60 metals that we have in the periodic table, and we are right now recycling maybe 20 of them, and 30 to 40 of these specialty metals are not at all recycled.
And for contrast, of those common metals that do get recycled, things like copper, iron, steel, zinc, what proportion of those would you estimate eventually gets recycled?
So those are, say, a dozen elements, and those we recycle typically 50 to 60%. The most iron, because there the least separation is necessary, but those we are recycling at a good rate.
Okay, so we've got a broad spectrum here. So tell me a little bit more. Why are some of these metals, like the precious metals used in industrial applications and the base metals like zinc and iron, why are those recycled more effectively and more efficiently than the more rare metals out there?
I think the most important question is always the economics. So does it make sense for the recycler to do so or not? So those big metals, the coppers and zinc, they arise in big volumes. So we have those big scrapyards where you have a lot of material. And also we have recycling technologies that are relatively straightforward. And also we have practice in doing so for several decades. So it's an established, well-known technology. And similarly, the precious metals, of course, we have the financial incentive. And again, from the technological side, they are easy to recycle in the sense that putting the metals into a smelter, afterwards you get them out in pure form, so it's technologically feasible. And at the other end of the spectrum are the specialty metals. First of all, we have very, very small volumes. You're using them often only in grams per device, so in very, very small amounts. For a recycler to have sufficient amounts that make it interesting to recycle something, that requires logistical efforts that need to be established. And the other problem with the specialty metals is that some of them behave differently thermodynamically, and so far we are missing the technology to retrieve those metals from the recycling process.
Hmm. So is it safe to say that consumer electronics is an industry where a lot of the metal used is wasted?
Yes, exactly. And consumer electronics, they are a special case also in that they use probably, in terms of quantity, the most diverse mix of metals, and they use them in very, very small amounts. And the other challenge about the electronics is that, especially the consumer electronics, they often have very short lifetimes. So we only use them for a few years, then we throw them out. And that means, as we are using them so much more, and the trend is so sharply increasing, that if we do not do a better job in the end-of-life recycling very soon, we are risking to lose a lot of those metals and won't be able to get them back.
Mm-hmm. So shifting gears here for a second, what role do social and cultural behaviors, including that of, you know, throwing out these devices, you know, what role do these behaviors play in our wasting of metals, and how do they compare to the technological limitations that we've already been talking about?
By far the biggest aspect of this is the collection. Are we collecting the material at all? And as we said earlier, the collection of the bulk metals, there we have established industries like the construction and demolition industries. So here the collection is actually working quite well. But with those recent consumer applications, the collection is a challenge, and that is unfortunately particularly true in industrialized countries. Like in Europe, we have the WEEE legislation for the electronic waste, but yet the collection rates are only around 30%, maybe 40%. And that means that however good a job you're doing later on in the recycling technologies in your final smelter, if you don't get the material in the first place, you have a big problem. And this situation, we realize, is very, very different in other parts of the world, where in emerging economies, where you often still have labor at a very low cost available. So the collection rates, they are often extremely high in those countries. But the problem then is that they don't have the recycling technology to really retrieve the metals from those products that they have collected. So in this respect, actually, there are some people who have suggested a best of two worlds approach, like India and China, for example, where you have big collecting industries. Let them do their really good job in collecting all those materials. But then in the end, let's put all the printed circuit boards on a big ship and bring them back to those two or three smelters in the world that can take those gold and platinum, but also a lot of other specialty metals out of the PCBs in a very efficient manner. So it's a lot about logistics.
So centralizing our recycling operations to, you know, a few specialty smelters around the world is one change that may improve metals recycling. But what are some other realistic and practical changes that can help transform the metals recycling industry?
In the very first place, focus on collection for all the materials, for all the different product groups, and try to increase the collection rate. Recycling needs to be part of our daily doing, and that applies both to the consumers in the private households, but of course also all the industries. And that is something which would make a tremendous difference. And the other aspect which could be done relatively easy is that once you have something at a scrapyard or a recycling processor, try a few steps of separation, dismantling the parts that are really the most valuable in terms of metals, like the printed circuit boards that you take out of your notebook before you put the notebook into the smelter, because it's those printed circuit boards that have by far the highest amount of the precious metals and the specialty metals. And then the notebook can go into a regular copper smelter, for example. But if these very basic dismantling steps are done at the beginning of the recycling process, you can really focus then your recycling technologies on the different metals that you're going for. Another aspect that would very much help the recycling efficiency in the future is if product designers could keep the recycling in mind, meaning that at the end of life of a product, that the disassembly of the different parts containing different valuable metals is relatively straightforward, and that those parts are also accessible and not somewhere in the middle of a product where they cannot be reached.
So who is in a position to enforce and execute these changes?
Everybody is the brief answer. And this includes every government, meaning we are thinking of recycling globally. So it needs to be done at a global level and provide targets, maybe increase them gradually, but also provide incentives both for the consumers. There are ideas, I have deposit fees, subsidies of some products, and also to industry, like provide incentives to a company to build a very efficient, modern recycling plant that uses those separation steps and sorting technology that exists out there. And in terms of industry and academia, both of them research, try to develop better recycling technologies for those specialty metals. And finally, the public. Everybody has to recycle.
Right. Great. Well, Barbara Reck, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having us.
Barbara Reck and co-author Thomas E. Gradle write a review on metals recycling in this week's special issue on waste.
For this special issue, Science produced a video that featured the Blue Plains Sewage Treatment Plant, where some of the latest advances in wastewater conservation are taking shape. It was fascinating, but it was also smelly, and I'm still feeling a little uneasy about the shoes that I wore that day. I spoke with Science news writer Greg Miller about the psychology of yuck and how a revulsion towards human waste is actually a strong force acting against important conservation efforts.
Well, we have this special issue this week on waste, and we thought it'd be interesting to look into whether there are situations where human psychology runs headlong into best practices. So are there situations where we have an effective strategy for handling waste that maybe gives economic benefits or environmental benefits or health benefits, but people are resistant to because of some psychological issue?
And that's really how I read this story, about how psychology can trump engineering and all those other things you just mentioned. Can you set up the problem for us when it comes to wastewater?
Yeah, so one of the areas where this seemed like it might obviously be an issue is when it comes to handling human sewage. And one issue there is reusing wastewater. Access to clean drinking water is increasingly becoming an issue for communities all around the world. And we actually have the technology to take treated water from sewage treatment plants and run it through a bunch of filters that take out all the organic matter and all the bugs, anything that might make people sick, and produce really clean water that meets all of the federal and state standards for drinking water.
Mm-hmm.
But people are sometimes resistant to doing that just because of the ick factor. They know where the water came from, and they have trouble kind of getting that out of their minds and drinking the water.
So this isn't really a technology problem, but is there a scientific explanation for people getting grossed out by this kind of thing?
Yeah, well, there's probably a pretty good reason that we're grossed out by our own excrement. Evolutionarily, pathogens were a great threat to our survival, and so it seems reasonable to assume that we evolved these intuitive disgust reactions to excrement, and that's why we try to avoid it at all costs.
In your story, you actually talk about people who make a study of disgust and our reactions to things that we think are gross. Can you describe some of their experiments?
One of the guys who was really a pioneer of scientific research on disgust is a man named Paul Rozin, a psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania. And back in the 80s, he did some now really classic experiments where he basically messed around with college undergrads. In one experiment, he says is one of his favorite, he gave them a piece of fudge that had been carefully crafted to look like a dog turd. And they told the people that this is chocolate. They asked them, oh, do you like chocolate? Of course, we love chocolate. But they just won't eat it. And it sort of illustrates that gut-level reaction that people have. In a bunch of follow-up experiments they did, they really showed how this intuitive disgust can just get almost bizarre. So in one experiment, they dipped a cockroach, a real cockroach, but one that they'd sterilized, so it was completely clean, but they dipped it into a glass of juice and asked people if they would drink it. And not surprisingly, they said, no, I'd rather not drink that.
Right.
But then things got kind of weird. They took that glass away, threw the cockroach away, brought out a clean glass and filled it with juice and said, okay, here, would you drink this juice that has been poured into a clean glass? And people were still reluctant to drink the juice. It was as if they thought the roachness had somehow contaminated all the juice, even though the roach had never been in contact with the juice that was there in the glass in front of them. So it's this kind of weird, magical thinking that people have that really kind of defies logic. And that's the kind of thinking that gets in the way of things like reusing wastewater.
Some of this aversion to things that revolt us might actually be a problem with how we perceive risk. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so people, it turns out, take a lot of mental shortcuts even when they're making fairly important decisions. And one thing that seems to happen is that once people make up their mind about a particular technology, say wastewater reuse, it influences how they perceive the risks of that technology. So if they have a gut reaction that wastewater reuse is bad, then they tend to think that the benefits of it are low and the risks of it are high, which isn't necessarily a rational response. And it's very different from how an expert would sort of methodically add up the risks and benefits of a technology. People do it on a more intuitive, emotional level. They decide it's bad, and if it's bad, it must have a lot of risk and not much benefit.
In the case of water reuse, this sounds like something people really need to get past. What kinds of approaches are being taken to get people past this point?
So people are trying a number of different things, and one thing that seems to help is educating people about the simple fact that essentially all water is recycled. Water on our planet is constantly cycling. For instance, if you live in a city that's on a river, you're in fact drinking the recycled wastewater of whatever communities are upstream from you. Because what happens is their water goes into a sewage treatment plant and treated and released into the river where it goes downstream and it becomes the input to your water system. And so once people start thinking about that and realizing that essentially they've been drinking recycled water all their lives, it seems to help overcome some of the resistance to intentional reuse of wastewater.
You also talk about taking perfectly clean treated water and just putting it back in the ground and so it finds its way to the water sources that people are used to water coming from.
In Orange County, there's one of the largest wastewater reuse facilities in the world, and there they purify 70 million gallons of water a day come out of that facility that could be sent right to people's kitchen sinks, but instead they pump it into the ground, into aquifers where it circulates with other water, and then eventually enters the water supply. And so that extra step of mingling with other water under the ground seemed to help increase the acceptance of the wastewater reuse project there.
So it's an engineering feat in attempt to overcome a psychological issue.
Yeah, it's kind of like an extra unnecessary engineering step that
right.
overcomes human psychology.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit here and talk about another set of taboos in your story, those surrounding solid waste or feces, excrement, and sanitation. Why is it important, in some cases, to overcome that fear?
Yeah, there are really strong taboos about feces. At a basic level, it's important because 2.6 billion people on the planet have no access to sanitation, and open defecation is the norm in huge parts of the developing world.
Mm-hmm.
And just getting people to talk about this issue, and it's a problem because people go out to the nearby fields to relieve themselves. The flies come, land on the feces, and fly in through their kitchen window and land on their food. So it's a great way to spread disease. But it's a lot easier to get people to talk about things like clean water. It's often hard to get people to talk seriously about sanitation, to get celebrities, for example, to be seen digging latrines or sitting on a latrine in the name of sanitation. It's really right. difficult. But there are other potential issues here, too. And one of them, there's a movement called ecological sanitation that wants to promote the use of composting toilets in parts of the developing and developed world, in particular in areas where water is scarce and there's a need for fertilizer for crops. This is a way of potentially, A, meeting the sanitation needs, which has health benefits, but also possibly increasing the yield of crops. So, again, getting people to use them is difficult sometimes because it requires a bit of, not too much, but a little bit of hands-on maintenance that people consider a little bit icky, I think. The places where these things have kind of taken hold seems to be where there's some other human need that they satisfy. You know, you can overcome your disgust if you stand to benefit economically or if you stand to benefit by virtue of your family not getting sick so often, things like that.
Okay. Well, Greg Miller, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Greg Miller is a science news writer for the San Francisco area. He writes about getting our minds out of the sewer in this week's special issue on waste.
The eventual end to waste and wasteful behavior is a lovely image, but how do we get there? In this week's editorial, Janet Herring argues that contemplating this light at the end of the sewer will require confronting all the ways in which we generate and manage our discarded materials, as well as rethinking the very definition of the word waste. Science's Meghna Sachdev spoke with Herring about what's needed to reduce the waste we produce.
One issue is that once something is defined as waste, especially in industrialized countries, certain types of constraints and requirements and regulations come into place. And that's the point of this end of waste status that the European Union Environment Agency has created, is to return a material that's already been used to the same status as a virgin material, and so that it no longer carries this label of waste and all the regulatory requirements that go along with being a waste product. And I think that it is important from the point of view of protecting human health and the environment that we're careful about the difference between waste material and a new resource. But at the same time, once there is not really a significant difference, we need to let go of some of the constraints that go along with handling a waste material.
And apart from these restrictions, would you say that one of the obstacles is some sort of either a psychological hurdle or some sort of cultural aversion people have to something once it's defined as waste?
I think that's certainly true, and it probably manifests itself in different ways. Some of it is just wanting something new instead of something used. Sometimes there are real issues with safety or reliability for something that's been used or discarded, and that's an important issue. There's also a much larger issue that comes into play when we talk about, say, recovering water from wastewater, where there's very strong cultural and just psychological issues having to do with human waste. These things all come into play, and people need to have the information so that they can make an informed decision that tries to separate out some of the emotional part of it from what could be a real risk.
So what would you say is the most important step that needs to be taken to get people past this psychological hurdle?
I think the first step is for people to understand how unsustainable our current practice is. If people feel that there's no problem, then they also feel, and rightfully so, that they don't need to change anything. And it's only when the problem is actually identified that people understand that there is a need to do things differently. I think that's really where it starts. We should understand that our current use of resources and our current consumption patterns and our current ways of dealing with waste are just not sustainable in the long term.
We were talking about people's aversion to waste, and you mentioned recovering water from wastewater. Could you go into that a little bit?
Well, a good example of this is in Singapore. They do what's called direct potable reuse, which means they take their wastewater and they treat it up to a point that it's at a drinking water standard, and then in fact it is directly used in the drinking water system. And that's something that is accepted by the population, partly because they've developed a very, very strong educational and outreach program so that people understand what the process is, but also because that system, to be honest, doesn't allow for too much dissent. If you contrast that to what was attempted in California, this is a number of years ago, then actually a process that was not even anywhere close to what's being done in Singapore was labeled toilet to tap. That was the buzzword. And there was a great cartoon that showed a dog standing next to a toilet, and it said, toilet to tap. It sounds fine to me. But it didn't sound fine to the consumers in Southern California. And that was not able to go ahead because of the opposition of the public. And it is probably the case that some of that opposition was based in real risk, but it's also true that some of that opposition was based on emotion and psychology. And those need to be dealt with in a way that allows resources to be used sensibly.
Right. At least in the United States, originally, when it came to recycling, people weren't really that enthusiastic about recycled products. But, you know, now the more recycled, the better. Is that sort of response what we need to be aiming for?
I think that's a big part of it. And I think you're right. There is more interest among the general public in having recycled products and being able to recycle products. But at the same time, we have to realize that if the overall consumption trend increases and continues to increase, then recycling is not going to solve the problem. That we also actually have to look at the overall consumption patterns. There's some interesting examples that fuel efficiency in the United States and other developed countries for cars has been improving over the years, and yet the fuel use has stayed more or less the same, and that's because the amount of driving has been increasing. So you don't gain that much just from recycling. It has to be part of a larger picture.
So, right, we've talked a lot about reusing waste, but what that means is that we need to work on just reducing it rather than just reusing it. Is that right?
I think that's a very important point. I think that we need to decrease the intensity of our society, both in terms of energy resources and other types of natural resources. And some of that can come from recycling or reuse, but some of it needs to come also from simply reducing the overall demand.
Wonderful. Thanks very much.
Janet Herring writes about the end of waste in an editorial this week. For our full collection on working with waste, visit www.sciencemag.org/special/waste, where you can find reviews, perspectives, and news stories, plus a data-driven infographic and videos on the toilets of the future, wastewater management, and getting energy from sewage. You can also join the conversation on Twitter with the hashtag #TrashyScience. And that concludes the August 10th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.